dass wir zunächst an männliche Akteure oder Opfer denken, wenn wir von Streiks, zivilem Ungehorsam, von Verhaftungen und Folter lesen oder hören. Aber eigentlich wissen wir aus eigener Erfahrung hier, dass dieses Bild einseitig ist und falsch. Denn eine Frau hat diese Kinder und Männer geboren, hat ihnen gekocht, tröstet sie, gibt ihnen Halt und Hoffnung, trauert um sie, ersetzt sie, wenn sie weg sind oder tot. Das kennen wir Frauen hier ja auch. Zuständig sein für die Reproduktion unserer Lieben, damit sie am Morgen wieder hinaus mögen in die Arbeitswelt, in Kampf und Politik. Nur mit dem unendlich großen Unterschied, dass wir, Frauen und Männer hier, ein Zuhause haben, dass unser Leben nicht von Besatzung, Krieg, Flüchtlingsdasein und materieller Armut geprägt ist und wir Frauen hier somit viel einfachere Voraussetzungen haben, diesen Teufelskreis von geschlechtlicher Fixierung auf die Souffleurrolle aufzubrechen. Wie ist das für die palästinensischen Frauen? Wie haben sich jahrzehntelanger Kampf und Widerstand auf ihr Leben ausgewirkt? Welche Handlungsmöglichkeiten und welche Hoffnungen haben und leben sie? Inwiefern haben 17 Jahre Besatzung ihre Lebensbedingungen verändert? Wo stehen sie, mehr als die Hälfte des palästinensischen Volkes, im Kampf um ein befreites Land und um ein befreites Leben? Diejenigen, die Sahar Khalifas Romane kennen, haben ein eindrucksvolles Zeugnis über den Alltag in den besetzten Gebieten erhalten, welches Einblick auch in die besondere Situation der Frauen gibt. Dass Sahar Khalifa bereit war, nach Zürich zu kommen und persönlich und direkt zu diesen Fragen Stellung zu nehmen, freut uns sehr. Wir möchten Sie herzlich begrüßen und ihr danken.
Thank you.
Martin Dahinden, der Sahar Khalifas Roman Feigenkaktus lektoriert hat und wesentlich beteiligt war, diesen Abend zu organisieren, stellt nun die Autorin vor. Dann wird Sahar Khalifa reden und schließlich besteht dann die Möglichkeit, Fragen zu stellen und zu diskutieren.
Sahar Khalifa wird heute Abend mit Ihnen über die Rolle der palästinensischen Frauen reden und aus diesem Grund sind die meisten von Ihnen wohl auch hergekommen. Doch was Sahar Khalifa über die Situation der Frauen sagt und was Sie nun bald hören werden, ist untrennbar verbunden mit ihrer Arbeit als Schriftstellerin. Sahar Khalifa ist manchen hier in der Schweiz als Autorin bekannt. Vor einem Jahr wurde ihr Band Der Feigenkaktus in deutscher Übertragung veröffentlicht. Und wie bei wenigen Büchern erhielt der Verlag nach kurzer Zeit Reaktionen von Leserinnen und Lesern, die beeindruckt waren, wie Sahar Khalifa über die Wirklichkeit schreibt, die sie erlebt. Aus ihren Texten wird sichtbar, dass Sahar Khalifa davon ausgeht, dass die Wirklichkeit nur dann verändert werden kann, wenn sie in ihrer Widersprüchlichkeit begriffen wird. Von der sprachlichen Inszenierung eines politischen Dogmas hält sie wenig. Es gehört zu meiner kleinen Rolle an diesem Abend, Sahar Khalifa als Person knapp vorzustellen. Denn über ihre biografischen Daten weiß ich unterdessen gut Bescheid, weil ich von den Behörden mit einer Unmenge von Formularen und Anfragen belästigt wurde, bevor das Schweizer Konsulat in Chicago Sahar Khalifa das Visum ausstellte, das zur Einreise erforderlich war. Sahar Khalifa wurde 1941 in Nablus auf der Westbank als Tochter einer wohlhabenden Familie geboren. Als sie 18 Jahre alt war, wurde für sie auf traditionelle Weise eine Heirat arrangiert. Sie blieb 13 Jahre verheiratet und hatte zwei Kinder. Wirtschaftlich abhängig und ohne die Möglichkeit, sich außer Hauses weiterzubilden, wurde während der Zeit ihrer Ehe das Lesen von Büchern sehr wichtig. Im Verlaufe der 60er Jahre begann Sahar Khalifa auch zu schreiben. Ihr erstes Buch, Es trug den Titel nach der Niederlage und wurde 2 Jahre nach dem Junikrieg von 1967 beendet. Dieses Buch erschien allerdings nie, weil das Manuskript von den Israelis beschlagnahmt wurde und verschwunden blieb. 2 Jahre nachher erschien in Kairo das zweite Buch, Wir sind nicht mehr eure Sklaven. Ein richtiger Erfolg wurde aber erst der dritte Band, Der Feigenkaktus, der 1976 auf Arabisch erschien und etwas später auf Hebräisch, Französisch und Holländisch und wie Sie gehört haben eben auch auf Deutsch und sogar eine englische Übersetzung soll in den nächster Zeit erscheinen. Zaha Khalifas neuester Roman, Die Sonnenblume, ist ein umstrittenes Buch. Umstritten wegen der Art und Weise, wie Zaha Khalifa darin die Rolle der Frau in der palästinensischen Gesellschaft zum Ausdruck bringt. Über die Reaktionen palästinensischer Politiker und Literaten und Politikerinnen und Literatinnen, ich bitte Sie da zu entschuldigen, auf dieses Buch könnte selber ein abendfüllendes Programm gemacht werden. Und was Zaha heute Abend sagen wird, gehört gewissermaßen auch zur Debatte um dieses Buch. Das werden Sie nun bald hören. Besten Dank.
Thank you, Martin. As my colleague and my friend Martin has said, the problem or the question which I'll be raising tonight needs special attention from all of you. If you are a Swiss woman, I need your special attention because our problem and our question has a universal nature, international. It's just like the workers' question. I learn from your experience. You learn from mine. Your independence and your liberation inspire my liberation. My sociopolitical situation might reveal the hidden dynamics in your own conflicting situation within your society, because within my own situation, things are sharper, and that's why they are clearer. So you can learn from me. And I need your special attention. If you are a Swiss man, I also need your special attention, because you will learn more through me, you might, about your own women. When you understand her better, you will love her better. And she, in turn, will love you better. So you will have an interest in hearing me. If you are an Arab man, I need your very, very special attention. Because I'm opening a dialogue tonight, which we need. And we need it for so many long, long years. One of the militant women who were in Beirut here says, we are walking on 2 legs. One of them is crippled and impeded. The one which is healthy is the political one, and the one which is crippled and impeded is the social one. And by God, I don't believe there is a revolution that can walk on just 1 leg. So I need your special attention. If you are an Arab woman, this is your experience. And this is your opportunity. I have captured the voice of women in their 40s and 50s and 30s. I depicted it. I give it to you. Use it. It's yours. Now, since I have prepared you, I will stand. The Palestinian woman has acquired some basic characteristics that usually precede the formation of an actual women's liberation movement. An educated potential leadership has developed, but the other decisive factor, communal power, is still unmoved. The reason why a massive movement has not taken place in a political situation that invites it is basically the leadership's incapacity to reach and inspire women's dormant power. In this paper, I intend to discuss our past tactics in the hope of finding better means and subtler techniques to help the Palestinian woman develop as a productive and effective social and political power. To begin with, I will briefly summarize the historical influences that brought the recent changes among Palestinian women, and later on explore the prospects and possibilities of a women's movement in the occupied territories. Now, I will give you a glimpse of the educational background of the Palestinian woman, which is, of course, not separated from the educational background of the Palestinian man and the movement, the educational movement of the whole Palestinian society. In 1948, when the majority of the Palestinian people found themselves homeless, jobless, penniless, they realized that they could regain their social and economical status, which they lost by losing Palestine, if they invest their minds, the only capital left to them. By educating their children, these people hoped to find places to live in and salaries to earn in the neighboring Arab states, especially in the oil countries. This attitude of educating children started among the middle class and soon spread among the other classes and became a social and national phenomenon which you hear about. Out of financial need and through political pressure, the Palestinians learned the importance of education as a means for survival. If you are educated, this is quote unquote, if you are educated, you get a job and a place to live. This was a common belief, and everybody seemed to follow the track. This is how the Palestinians became among the most educated people in the Middle East, and this is also how the Palestinian woman, affected by the needs of the socio-political circumstances, became more educated and relatively more conscious than other women in the area. The political upheavals brought change in the life of the Palestinian woman and pushed her forward. Since 1948, the educated daughter has become a major source of income for the Palestinian family. In her new economic role, the educated Palestinian woman has undergone a change in her social status. Thus, a considerable change in her image started to emerge. An educated woman's role in life is no longer limited to cleaning the floor, washing the dishes, and breeding children. She is viewed now as a responsible member of the family who is expected to work, earn money, and help the family to have better living conditions. However, the developments which the Palestinian woman has undergone is not definite. For occupation brought other changes and attitudes which seem to have pushed the woman backward and shaken her newly won position. Imprisoned in the big ghettos of the West Bank and Gaza, A woman could no longer leave to other parts in the Arab world to look for a job easily. The West Bank and Gaza were surrounded by the military forces, and the movement has been limited by the fear of the Israeli soldiers and the trouble of the hectic journey across the bridge. You hear about the bridge. Besides, the opportunities for work in the Arab countries have been reduced to a minimum by developments in those countries. Also, there is the fear of the family split, an experience which many Palestinian families passed through during the consecutive wars. The outcome of those wars resulted in splitting innumerable families. There are people who have not seen their families for 3 decades or more. Some of them lost track with their families forever. Now, because of these reasons and other minor ones, it is no longer approved to send the educated daughter to a place outside the occupied territories. After all, quote, the woman is the weaker part of the family, and the risk of leaving home, if to be done, should be done by the man. This became the prevailing belief and attitude, and accordingly, the woman had to stay at home in the occupied territories, even if she was educated and capable of work outside the country. Now, there is a phenomenon in the occupied territories. And this phenomenon, which I will explain, has a tremendous impact on the socio-political situation, which I would like to you, especially if you were Arab men, to listen with care, with particular care. There is the phenomenon of the increasing number of men in the occupied territories, and it is a fact. We have to face facts. If we don't like these facts, we have to change it, to change these facts. But to hide from them, there will be no solutions by hiding from these facts. The fact is that there is an increase, a decrease, in men's number. And as I mentioned earlier, the risk of leaving home has become mainly a man's responsibility. He leaves either in search for better chances of work or study, or to join the Palestinian resistance. Thousands of workers and students leave every year and do not come back except as visitors who pay a visit once or twice a year. The husband leaves his wife and children at home and remains in touch with them through the monthly salary he sends and the annual visits he pays. Now, during his absence, what happens to this woman who is left with a bunch of kids? This woman, during his absence, finds herself handling new responsibilities which were done solely by men. The responsibilities become greater and heavier if the man gets too much involved in his new life. And then he forgets about the wife and forgets about his children, and she finds herself the only responsible person in the family. In this case, the man stops sending money to his family and the woman has to fill the gap. On the other hand, a relatively large number of men who stay at home and do not succeed in finding work in their towns and villages become assimilated into the Israeli economy. They become tools of production for the occupiers. They are obliged to have a double life in which during the day they speak Hebrew, earn Israeli shekels, and offer their Arab sweat. At night, they come back home exhausted, nervous, and ready to sleep or to quarrel. This means that their beneficial effect on their social and political life, the social and political life of their society, is at a minimum. They are present absentees. Another type of absent presence is that of the political prisoners. Thousands of Palestinian men are jammed in the Israeli prisons. During the periods of their imprisonment, which might extend to several years, the woman finds herself alone, and she is obliged, of course, to do the man's work. This increases her responsibilities, which means that she has the previous responsibilities, which are the traditional ones, and now she's having new responsibilities, which she was not responsible for previously. Due to the displacement of the Palestinian men, the actual percentage of women within the Palestinian population in the occupied territories is rising. This considerable rise in women's number will have social and political impacts, which in the long run will be fatal. What we will have is a pool of unproductive majority in a society which needs all its powers to be mobilized to face the present challenges. The increase in the women's number was not accompanied by an increase in the chances for work or social and political involvement. The woman, though more economically and politically conscious, has few chances for productive activity. Her readiness is developing and accelerating because of the surrounding atmosphere, yet her powers are left unemployed. Such pooling of unconsumed potential will eventually create a general feeling of frustration and apathy, which is the natural outcome of unreleased power or unreleased energy. Now, I will give a description of the condition, the real condition of the Palestinian woman under occupation. The majority of those who participated in organized political and social activities in the Palestinian struggle were working, middle class, educated women. As shown in several studies made outside the occupied territories, like Ghazi al-Khalili's study, published by the PLO publishing houses or information center, like Khadija Abu Ali's study published by the Palestinian Union of Women, and like studies, separate studies published in the Palestine Studies in Beirut, these studies show that middle class women, why did they become more involved more than other women? That's because they learned. They had the means to learn and develop social and political awareness. Their education qualified them to get jobs outside the home. In contact with larger society, they were able to develop a feeling of responsibility towards their social problems and thus work for a change. Of course, a woman who is not educated or who does not work outside her home, the possibility of getting in contact with her society will be at a minimum. Sometimes she does not understand what's going on. Sometimes she feels completely out of the society. But when she is educated, she can get a job, she gets in contact with society, and thus she becomes aware of the problems. Although a relatively small number of Palestinian women participated in the organized struggle, their presence affected the image of all Palestinian women and made it seem as though en masse they were active socially and politically. But recent developments in the social and political situation prove that the revolution of the Palestinian woman is still unachieved. The new fundamentalist wave, which has drawn thousands of women back to the veil and the old concepts about women, sex, and society, emphasize the fact that the Palestinian woman's situation is far less improved than we would like to believe. In fact, women's situation in general is as bad as before the revolution, if not worse. The majority of women still lack social and political consciousness while being exploited and oppressed. The educated minority have been unable to loose themselves from the tangling ties of the decadent past. And the gap between the educated and the uneducated, between the activists and the pacifists, or the passive majority, the passive majority, remains unbridged. Now I will give a closer look. I will split women into factions, into pieces, because you cannot just make a conclusion by looking from outside what Leila Khaled had done, what Maysayer had done. We have to be more careful if we want to make plans based on scientific conclusions. We have to look closer. And this is what I'm going to do. I will split women into factions. Now I will take the uneducated majority. The uneducated majority continues leading dull, backward lives with little social and political involvement. The illiterates and semi-educated, between brackets, which is primary and preparatory education, who make up the majority among Palestinian women, are the least aware and conscious. They are the women belonging to the oppressed classes, including the laborers, peasants, minor professionals, and clerks. And according to Ghazi Khalili's study, according to Khadija Abu Ali's study, this is the case. I'm not bringing something from me, and also with my own studies in the occupied territories. This is the situation. The living conditions of these women are bad. They live in narrow houses, badly ventilated and heated. Their rooms are stuffed with children and grandparents and aunts and other unemployed members of the extended family. They usually inhabit the villages or the crowded refugees' camps or the dark slums of the old cities. Most of these women do not work outside their homes, so they are financially dependent. If they do work, it is in Israeli industry or in the services sector. They are burdened by housework and the changing moods of their husbands. They are encircled and watched by their husbands and parents and neighbors and other inhabitants of the slum. They worry about their own reputation and look around in fear of a scandal that might bring them a disaster or a criminal action. Few of those women read. Most hear the news only by accident. They watch Jordanian television and make sure not to miss any episode of soap operas. They pride themselves on their continuous pregnancies. They consider marriage the beginning and the end of the world. The borders of their universe are the thresholds of their quarters. Therefore, their socio-political activities are confined to shouting at the Israeli soldiers and dropping plant pots on their heads when they pass beneath their windows. For the majority, religion is their only source of culture beside the Jordanian TV. Divorce and polygamy are facts of life. They are the will of God, whom the husband represents on earth. Now, to have a closer look, I will take you closer and closer and closer and Till you feel that you are a woman yourself, I hope, but please have a modern idea or a modern mentality and not to be offended by having this opportunity of becoming a woman yourself. Now, to have a closer look at the socio-psychological condition of the Palestinian woman, I shall use two characters of my novel Sunflower. These are fictional characters rooted in reality. Saadiye represents the masses or the uneducated majority, and Rafif represents the educated minority. Now let's have a look at Saadiye. Saadiye, who is the representative of the uneducated majority. Saadiye is a woman of many children. She's young, pretty, and almost illiterate. Saadiye is a true example of the majority of Arab women in general, and the Palestinian women in particular. Her husband was a worker in the Israeli industry. He joined the resistance and was killed in one of the military operations. Saadiye, who knows nothing except to cook and clean and breed children, finds herself completely alone with a bunch of kids. She starts working in Israeli industry as a seamstress. Her neighbors notice that her lot improves. They can't believe that a woman like Saadiye is capable of working and bringing in money through decent channels. So they start spreading rumors about her until they make her life impossible and miserable. You know what they say about her. You know what are the rumors, saying that she's a whore, she's a prostitute. Because of these rumors, she decides to leave the quarter or the neighborhood and to go somewhere else. Now, Abu al-Izz, who is a PLO secret member in the occupied territories, hears the news and hurries to prevent Saadiye from leaving the neighborhood. He cries desperately. He says, "You leave the neighborhood? You are the neighborhood. تترك الحارة انت الحارة يا سعدية انت الحارة كيف تترك الحارة؟" "You are the neighborhood. Where? Why?" Saadiye answers. Listen. She says, "People have slaughtered me. They forget the Israelis and remember me. They hit the soldiers with one stone and hit me with 10. As we have seen, the politician, the fighter, reminds Saadiye of her national duty. And Saadiye reminds him of the social threats that surround her. He reminds her of her position in the national struggle. And she says, "They forget the Israelis and remember me." What does that mean? What does it mean? It simply means that where women are concerned, the sexual considerations are more important in the Arab world than the national. This is a fact. We have to face it. The woman, even under occupation, is still evaluated by her sexual behavior rather than by her national stances and productivity. The Arab woman is taught since childhood that sexual considerations come first, and anything else, even the national question, come second or third or fourth. We cannot ask Saadiye now to change her situation and her behavior towards the nation, while the nation insists on feeding her with the same values and the same threats. The Arab woman did not choose sex to be the determining factor of life and death. She was brought up to believe that sex was the center and the cause when any factor becomes the center of life and the cause of existence, anything else becomes void and irrelevant. And in this situation, it would be out of the question to remind Saadiyya or any other Saadiyya or any other woman of her national duties without asking the national atmosphere and the social background to open up for her to meet such demands and necessities. This is natural. Now, how can we do it? It takes ages. And we need to be liberated soon. But let me continue. Now, we take the other segment or the other faction of the woman, the educated woman, and please, my dear friends, Swiss women, listen, because there is some kind of relevance here between us. Rafif represents the working, educated Palestinian woman. She is a college graduate in her late 20s. She works for a progressive journal called Al-Balad, which means in Arabic, the country. Al-Balad magazine, the country magazine, where all other employees are men. The magazine in this novel symbolizes the complex Palestinian institution in general, with its hierarchy and different conflicting ideologies. Examples of how the magazine is structured and how it functions will appear in the way the editorial board deals with the women's corner. You know the women's corner. They give us a corner, and this is our corner, which Rafif edits. When Rafif started working for the magazine, she was against having pages set aside for women. She believed then that women's problems are part of the national problem, and that women's liberation was tied to that of the nation. All of us educated women used to have this stance. Whether Leila Khalid, whether May Sayegh, whether my colleagues, we all had this stance. That our liberation was tied to that of the nation. Since she was a proponent of socialist ideas, she thought that women's liberation was tied to class liberation. And like her other leftist colleagues, she believed that focusing on the women's question during occupation would help split the national front by diverting women's attention from the real enemy, which is Israel. She also thought that dealing with the problems of women separately was betrayal of socialist ideology, the ideology which promises the liberation of women as soon as the oppressed classes take over and establish socialist rule. How the women, as members of the oppressed classes, would achieve their liberty was by concentrating on helping the working class acquire power. In the meantime, women should forget their special problems and fears and pain until the proletariat reach power and establish equality between classes and sexes. This was Rafif's stance, which is the educated woman. Whether these claims are practical was not Rafif's concern, for the theory seemed clear and sound. But to her dismay, she discovered a gap between theory and reality. And her attitude towards women's issues presented in the women's corner changed. Rafif's new stance resulted from a down-to-earth experience which she shared with her leftist friend, Adel. She has a boyfriend They don't have, like here, being a boyfriend, it means that you go together all the time and share one apartment and so on. A friend in the occupied territory is that he's a colleague, you like him, you sit with him in a cafeteria or a cafe, you have coffee with him, and you see each other almost every day. You discuss things, you plan things. You might be involved in the same organization, which is a secret underground organization, but it doesn't have the same sense like in the West. So Rafif has this experience with Adel, the leftist. From this experience, she realized that the way leftist men understand her problems are as a woman was both subjective and insufficient. Four, the leftists forget, or mean to forget, that women's problem is twofold: productive and reproductive dash sexual. So it is twofold. These two sides are equally important, and both need to be changed. Addressing one side, the productive, as the leftists do, is not enough. Men know this very well, where their own lives are concerned. But when it comes to women, their argument either falls short or falls apart. So Rafif discovers that what men confess in theory concerning women does not necessarily mean that they are ready to apply. Excuse me. For example, leftists believe that time is a crucial element in deciding the timing of change or revolution. If the community is ready for change, the revolutionist must lead. If not, he must wait until it becomes ready. Concerning women, however, the leftist is likely to ignore timing, especially on the personal level. For instance, if a relationship with a female comrade or a colleague, when he has such a relationship, he wants her to dispense free sex without considering the element of time. For us, this is unaccepted. When she reminds him of this element, he accuses her of being anti-revolutionary and traditional. Now, the beginning of feminist awareness. Now, let me define feminism, because I don't want men to be frightened from this word. Feminism means a political stance, taking a political stance towards your problems as a sex. Just taking a stance towards your problems as a nation. Just taking a stance towards your problem as a class. So this is what feminism means. Rafif used to believe, before passing the mentioned experience with Adel, that she was equal to men, despite the prevailing social and religious values of Arab society. Accordingly, she also believed that she could live her life as freely as men without special restrictions. She thought that oppressed people could avoid oppression if they were capable of rejecting it intellectually. This hypothesis is metaphorically represented in the novel's first scene as a down street in Jerusalem, where Rafif is walking with her friend Adel. Rafif tries to cross the street before the green light turns. A car almost hit her, but Adel pulls her back in time. He warns her, "You will be hit one day." She says, "By then, I would have crossed the street." He says, "Does it bother you if you wait for the right time? By that, you win your life and do not frighten people, and allow the traffic to go on." She says, But I gave people an example to follow. He said, your example is risky because it's out of time. It's risky because it's out of time. She says, let them forget, let them wait then. They might wait for a long time. He says, your example might delay their procession because it might scare them. They might blame you instead of following you. Now, Adil's view in this scene is that the leader should wait for the right time before revolting against the rules of a given situation or system. Such time comes when people are ready to follow the example.